We are working our way through the book of Galatians at a brisk clip, and we've actually completed the first chapter already. And last week we discovered that Paul was very excited about this point, that he did not receive the gospel from men in the ordinary way that men did in his day and age. He did not receive it from the apostles or from the community of followers of the apostles. Instead, he received personal communication direct from heaven, a revelation, a visitation from heaven on the road to Damascus. And he made a big deal about this, about how he did not receive the gospel from men, right? And about how he didn't receive the gospel from men, and about how his gospel, the gospel of Paul, Paul's gospel, was unique and not the same as the gospel that was commonly proclaimed by the rest of the apostolic community in that day and age. And so he says in verse 11 of chapter 1, "For I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. For I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation." Through a revelation of Yeshua, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And so he went on to recount the story of how he used to be a persecutor of the believers and how he pursued them with zeal, zealous, as if he was doing God a favor by afflicting them. That is until the revelation of Yeshua on the road to Damascus, of which he says in verse 15. He says, "But when he who had set me apart before I was born, and who called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son to me, in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me. But I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus." And we learn that he spent 3 years in Damascus, and only after 3 years in Damascus did he return to Jerusalem. In the book of Acts, we learn that on his, in the result of his coming back from Damascus to Jerusalem, when he arrived in Jerusalem, the believers there were afraid of him. They didn't receive him. They were afraid. You know, they thought, well, sure, he's had a conversion. He's here to beat us up. And it wasn't until Barnabas, Joseph Barnabas vouches for him, because Barnabas is from the early community, Joseph Barnabas, and he vouches for him and says, "No, I was with him in Damascus. He's not faking. This is real." And so he introduces him to James, Yaakov, Hatzari, the brother of the master. And he introduces him to Kepha, Shimon, Kepha. And he spends 2 weeks with Peter and his family in Jerusalem. In the book of Acts, Paul recounts that at the end of those 2 weeks, he was in the temple, he was praying in the temple, and he had a vision of the Master telling him, "Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles." And there was a plot launched against him, and he ended up fleeing Jerusalem to get out for, you know, the brothers in Jerusalem hurried him out to the coast, out to Caesarea, plopped him on a ship, and sent him on his way, and he ended up in Tarsus, his native city. So we read in Galatians, it's just a review from last week, you know. We read in verse 21, "Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia." That's his native Tarsus. "And I was still unknown in person to the assemblies of Judea," the churches, the synagogues of Judea that are in Messiah. "They only were hearing it said, 'He who used to persecute us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy.' And they glorify God because of me." But while Paul was there, while he was hanging out back in Tarsus, preaching the faith he once tried to destroy in the synagogues there, An amazing thing was happening in the city of Antioch. We learned, we're still reviewing. But we picked this up in Acts 11. And you might want to turn there. In fact, please do if you're following along in a Bible. Acts 11:19. And I'm going to ask you, you know how preachers say this sometimes, keep a finger in Galatians if you can, though, because we're going to flip back and forth. Acts 11, Galatians, back and forth like that, okay? The two stories go together at this point. So Acts 11, this was going on while Paul was in Tarsus in those so-called silent years. It says in verse 19, "Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews," which was the normal gospel that Paul was talking about. To no one except for Jews. That's exactly what we're talking about. Man's gospel. "But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who on coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists also, preaching the Lord, preaching the Master, Yeshua. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number who believed turned to the Lord. And the report of this came to the ears of the assembly, the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas to Antioch." You see, what's concerning the believers back in Jerusalem, what's concerning the believers is that these are not Jewish people who are becoming believers in Antioch, but rather what's happening is the God-fearing Gentiles that we've been discussing, the God-fearing Gentiles who are meeting in the synagogue, are entering the faith. And so they send out Barnabas to investigate. Barnabas is one of the originals. They send out Barnabas to investigate. Barnabas goes, and we read, "When he came and saw the grace of God, he was glad, and he exhorted them all to remain faithful to the Lord with steadfast purpose. For he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith. And a great many people were added to the Lord. So Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul." Why did Barnabas go to Tarsus to look for Saul? Because he needed his help. He needed Shaul's help. He needed Paul's help. Why? In overseeing the conversions of these Gentiles. He wanted someone with Paul's standing, Paul's halakhic credentials. Paul, a disciple under Gamaliel. Paul, one of the students of the Sanhedrin. He needed somebody with high halakhic credentials, because this was not just a few. This was not just a dozen. This was probably in Antioch, in the city of Antioch, hundreds. Hundreds of Gentiles. What are you going to do with hundreds of Gentiles? So he goes to get Paul. He says, "Paul, bring a sharp knife." Verse 26 says, "And when he found him, he brought him to Antioch. For a whole year they met with the church and taught a great many people." They met with the church. "And in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians." Now, when it says they met with the church, you have to understand this is just a word for synagogue, for assembly. And when it says they were first called Christians, this is the name, I believe, based on Zetterholm's work, this was the name of their synagogue. The synagogue of the Christianos, the Christ followers. The synagogue, or better yet, to put it into our vernacular, if it wasn't Greek, if it was, you know, if we would say it, the synagogue of the Messianics. The Messianic synagogue. Paul spends a whole year there in Antioch, and here's the thing. Here's the thing that surprised everyone. He didn't do any conversions. Instead, this is what made his gospel so radical, we were learning last week. So radical that he taught the Gentiles of Antioch to stay that way, to remain as Gentiles. And he taught this really, really risky, progressive idea about Gentile inclusion in the kingdom, even in the synagogue, even in Israel, even without conversion, without becoming Jewish. And this is what he called my gospel. This is what made it different from the gospel that Peter was preaching, and that James was preaching, and that John was preaching. And that's where we left Paul last week in Antioch, among the Jewish believers, teaching the God-fearing Gentiles. So now we're ready to get back to Galatians, and we start in Galatians 2. Galatians 2, verse 1, where it says, "Then after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me." Not 14 years since he got to Antioch, 14 years since the Damascus Road incident, I believe. Either that, or 14 years since the last time he had been to Jerusalem. But the point is that it's been a long time since he saw the apostles, since he saw the other apostles, since he saw the disciples. It's been more than a decade. And he finally goes back to Jerusalem. I want you to understand the significance of Jerusalem for the believers, for Paul and for the other believers of that day and era in the diaspora. It's not only the holy city. It's not only the place of the Beit HaMikdash. It's not only the place of the Master's empty tomb. It's the place of the Messianic kingdom. Yes, it's the place of David's throne where the Messiah is going to reign and rule. It's more than all of that, though, for them at that time, in that day, and in that age. Because in that time, Jerusalem was the place of the apostles, the elders, the original disciples. They had a synagogue there. They had an academy, I am sure. They had their own Beit Din, for certain. They had Yaakov, James, the brother of the Master, James, the righteous. Jerusalem of that era is hard for Protestants to understand and appreciate, because we have disrespect for authority. Protestants disrespect authority, but I think Catholics would understand this analogy. If you're a Catholic and you come from a Catholic background, I think you understand, you can appreciate this, that Jerusalem was for the first century believers what the Vatican is for Catholics today, and not American Catholics. James, the brother of the Master, was to the first century believers an authority on par with or higher than how Catholics revere the Pope. That's for real. They were the authority. The buck stopped with them. They had the power to bind and the power to loose. And whatever they bound on earth was bound in heaven, and whatever they loosed on earth was loosed in heaven. They were the believer's equivalent of the Sanhedrin. They were the sages. So it is that after more than a decade, Paul's going back up to Jerusalem to the apostles. And he's taking with him a few traveling companions, Barnabas. It's a good idea to bring him with, you know, he vouched for him last time. And he's taking Titus. Now, I'm sure he didn't select these two guys for this particular reason. They're just his traveling companions. But Barnabas represents the original school of Jerusalem. He represents the old school, you could say, of the Yeshua movement. He was there since the first year. He was there since the year of the death and the resurrection. A Jewish believer, he's got credentials, good credentials. Titus represents the opposite extreme. Titus is a God-fearing Gentile from Antioch, uncircumcised, not Jewish, has not converted, and doesn't seem to be planning on it. One of Paul's students. So these two guys representing the two opposites, Paul, Barnabas, Titus, go up to Jerusalem. He says in this verse, after 14 years I went up, you know, which is Aliyah, going up. You always go up to Jerusalem. Going up, it's always called going up. And usually the Aliyah happens at a festival time, right? Because you have the three pilgrimage festivals. The festival of Passover, the festival of Pentecost, Shavuot, and the festival of Sukkot, Tabernacles. So these would be the three times of year you might choose one of those three times for you. If you have to go to Jerusalem, you're going to go at one of those three times of year, because those are the times of going up. So Paul says, I went up. I went up to Jerusalem. But what? He says, I went up. Why now? Why after 14 years? Because of a revelation. Which is the same word that he used when he said that, you know, God was pleased to reveal his son to me because of a revelation. What is a revelation? Apocalypse. Apocalypsis. In the Greek, it's the word apocalypse. And in English, apocalypse means a disaster, some catastrophic cataclysm, right? But that's not what it means in the Greek. It just in the Greek it means an unveiling. Because of an unveiling, and it refers to something from heaven that's revealed from heaven, something revealed from heaven. And so the book of Revelation is some, it was revealed, it was a vision. The whole thing is a vision. It's usually a revelation is a vision or a prophecy. In Paul's case, on the road to Damascus, it was a vision. He heard a voice from heaven. It was a bat kol. He heard a voice from heaven. In this case, you think about that. Paul's life, you just like run through Paul's life in your mind. Everything, he's like constantly coming and going on the basis of things revealed from heaven. He's charismatic, you know. He sees, at one point, the Spirit of Messiah appears to him. Yeshua himself appears to him in the Beit HaMikdash. He has a vision of Yeshua. He says, go, I'm going to send you to the Gentiles. At another time, he appears to him as he's trying to enter Bithynia and says, no. Turn around. And won't let him enter a different territory. He appears to him at Corinth. And God tells him at Corinth, stay in this city a long time. I have people here. It's like his going and his coming is dictated by these revelations, by visions, by communication from heaven. Now, you've probably had this experience yourself once or twice of receiving a revelation, of receiving communication from heaven. It's not uncommon for believers. You've probably received this, maybe a vision, maybe a dream, maybe some sort of strong impression, a word from the Word maybe, a word from the Lord. And we should learn from this, we should learn from Paul's example, that God offers us direction if we're about His business. If we are busy with the things that He would have us be busy with. He offers direction when necessary through His Spirit if we're willing to listen and respond. But in this particular case, thanks to Luke, the writer of the Gospel of Luke in the book of Acts, the Acts of the Apostles, we actually know the revelation to which Paul refers. I don't know if you knew this or not, but this is pretty cool. We know the revelation to which Paul refers, and it's back in Acts 11. I told you. In Acts 11, it says, now in these days, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. Prophets. And one of them, named Agabus. What would Agabus be? I don't know. Sorry. It's hard. I mean, underneath these Greek names, there's Hebrew names. And that's always fun to find. But I don't know what Agabus is. Anyway, one of them named Agabus stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there will be a great famine all over all the world. And this took place in the days of Claudius. So the disciples determined, everyone according to his ability, to send relief to the brothers, living in Judea. And they did so, sending it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So what's the revelation? The revelation is these prophets come down. These prophets are visiting from Jerusalem. They're prophets from Jerusalem. They're from the apostolic community in Jerusalem. And they're there. And one of them, we'll see this guy again later in the book of Acts. He has a word from the Lord. And he stands up and he prophesies in the midst of the assembly that there's going to be a famine. And the famine is going to spread over the entire region, the Roman, the Mediterranean Empire, or the Roman Empire around the Mediterranean. And when they hear this, the believers hear this, they say, you know who's going to be hit the hardest by this? It's going to be our brothers in Jerusalem. The brothers in Jerusalem and in Judea are going to be particularly hard hit by this famine. Because, why? Because they're communists. Because they've been sharing all things in common. And by now it's taken its toll. And it's, the community is impoverished. And it's without means to lay up provision for themselves. In fact, so much so, and in keeping with our master's teaching about giving all one's wealth to the poor, many of the early Jerusalem believers were known as Evyonim. Evyonim. Evyon is the Hebrew word for needy. Evyonim are needy ones. They were known as the needy ones. Evyonim. You know Evyonim because a couple centuries later the church fathers start to refer to a certain sect of Jewish believers as the Evyonim, comes to us as Ebionites. The Ebionites. They were identified as a sect of Jewish believers in the 2nd century, 3rd century, early 4th century. The Ebionites were the Jewish believers who rejected the virgin birth teaching. And that's how the church fathers distinguished them from the Nazarenes and the other sects of Jewish believers. Anyway, at this time, that's not the case. At this time, they're just poor. The Evyonim. And the Evyonim are going to be the hardest hit by this coming famine. So, they take up a collection. Prophets from Jerusalem saw the results are going to be devastating if some measure was not set aside for the Jerusalem community. And so, what do? They follow the Torah. What does the Torah tell us about Joseph? Joseph said there's going to be 7 years of famine. He lays up. The famine hasn't started yet. It's a prophecy. The famine hasn't started yet. So Joseph takes up a collection from Paul and Joseph. Joseph Barnabas. Joseph Barnaba takes up a collection from the community here in Antioch. There's a large community in Antioch. I just remember there's a story in the Talmud about these charity collectors that go to Antioch. This is different. It's unrelated. Never mind. But, they're from Jerusalem. The sages send them out. They end up in Antioch looking for money. So Antioch's a wealthy community. And they're going to send this gift. They're going to send this gift back to Jerusalem, and they're going to send it by the hands of Barnabas and Paul. Now, Agabus was right. This was not a false prophecy. His prophecy was accurate. This really did happen. A famine really did come to Judea about the year 44 Common Era. It did last 3 years. 3 years of drought. The Talmud refers to it as the years of scarcity. The famine was severe in Judea. Not only in Judea, Phoenicia, all the way up the coast. It stemmed from a drought. Josephus tells us food was really scarce, extremely expensive, and people died. Lots of people. Meanwhile, over in Abiadene, if you remember Abiadene. Yeah? Abiadene, okay, from a couple weeks ago. Iran. Meanwhile, over in Abiadene, Iran, King Azates, who has recently moved from being a God-fearing Gentile to being Jewish, who has undergone conversion. Meanwhile, King Azates and his mother, Queen Helena, who has also gone through the mikveh and become Jewish, they hear about the famine in Judea. And so he sends a large fortune. Josephus writes about it. He says, when Azates was informed of this famine, he sent great sums of money to the principal men in Jerusalem, to the sages. He emptied his coffers. And he received some criticism for this. I want to read you the passage from the Talmud regarding this story. Okay, this is from Bava Batra. Our rabbis taught, it is related of King Manobaz, that he dissipated all of his own hoards of wealth and the hoards of wealth of his fathers in the years of scarcity. His brothers and his father's household came in a deputation to him and said, your father saved money and added to the treasures of his fathers, and you are squandering them. And he replied, quoting Psalm 85:11, truth springs from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. And then he said, my fathers stored up wealth in a place which can be tampered with, but I have stored up wealth in a place which cannot be tampered with. This should sound familiar to you. As it says, righteousness and judgment are the foundation of his throne. My fathers stored up something which produces no fruits, but I have stored up something which does produce fruit. As it is written, say ye of the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their deeds. Isaiah 3:10. He said, my fathers gathered treasures of money, but I have gathered treasures of souls. As it is written in Proverbs, the fruit of the tzaddik is a tree of life, and he that wins souls is wise. My fathers gathered their wealth for others, which is the opposite of what they intended to do. But then they left it to others when they died. I have gathered for myself, as it says, and for you it shall be righteousness, tzedakah. Deuteronomy 24:13. My fathers gathered for this world. I have gathered for the world to come, as it says, thy tzedakah, thy righteousness, shall go before thee, and the glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. So the sentiments of King Azates regarding the charity that he was raising, these are obvious echoes of our Master's teaching. Obvious echoes. Do not store up for yourselves treasures here on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart is also. So Azates is transmitting the teachings of Yeshua to us through Tractate Bava Batra. I like that very much. But his words, sound like sort of this midrashic expansion. So, I mean, that's a whole other subject, another sermon. Leave it alone. Anyway, prior to that, Paul and Barnabas knew the famine was coming. And so they raised this collection and they set off for Jerusalem. When do they set out? We don't know. But I have a conjecture I'd like to share with you. Because we see a similar situation later on in Acts, where Paul raises another contribution for the believing community in Jerusalem later on in Acts, and then times his trip to bring the money up to Jerusalem and to deliver it to the Jerusalem community. And he times it so that he'll be there for one of the pilgrimage festivals, for Shavuot. So he times it so that he would be there for Shavuot. Because, you're going up to Jerusalem, you're going to go up at one of these three times of year. Because it's a mitzvah. You have a mitzvah to be there if you can. You have a mitzvah to be there if you can for these three festivals. So in this instance, here's my theory, in this instance, Paul and Barnabas leave Antioch, set out for Jerusalem, carrying a significant sum of money concealed on their persons, intending to arrive on time to keep the Passover in Jerusalem with the apostles and with the brethren there. And we can imagine that they do so. They're eager to be in Jerusalem for the Passover. Paul has not been there in over a decade. It's been 14 years since he had a lamb at his Seder. It's been 14 years since he's been able to participate in the sacrifices of Passover. So imagine the anticipation to be, we're going to be in Jerusalem for Passover this year. And we're going to be having a Seder, and we're going to recline at the table with those who reclined at the table of the Master at his last Seder. I think they're excited. So they're going up. And don't forget, this was Passover during the days of the temple. Just a totally different experience. So they would have timed their arrival to be within, you know, maybe a month before Passover. Best case, get there about a month ahead. At a minimum, you have to be there more than a week ahead, or forget it, the deal's off. You have to, because it takes 7 days to go through the purification rituals to prepare for eating the sacrifices, which is just standard procedure for pilgrims. So they had to be there at a minimum a week ahead of Passover. And they get there, I think it's a month ahead when they arrive. But imagine their surprise, having arrived in Jerusalem, and they find the community of believers are mourning. Everyone is in mourning. Everyone's sitting Shiva. Everyone's on the floor. Terrible news. Yaakov ben Zavdai. Not the brother of the Master, but the brother of John. Yaakov is dead. Yaakov beheaded. Yaakov has been beheaded by Herod. By Herod Agrippa. So we read in Acts chapter 12, about that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And when he saw it pleased the Judeans, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread. So I try to imagine the impact of this on the community. This is the first time they've lost one of the 12. He's the first of the 12 to die. There was this hope. Some of you standing here today will not taste death. There is this hope. So imagine the shock and the surprise. James is dead. James beheaded. Yaakov. There was no miraculous escape this time. And for Paul, the old persecutor, once the chief persecutor of the community show up this time, it's just... it's too coincidental. Anyway, the community is shaken, and James isn't the only one that's arrested, right? Because Peter gets arrested in the middle of the festival. I don't know. Did Paul and Barnabas get to spend their Seder with the apostles? I don't know. Maybe. You know, it's possible that Paul had family in Jerusalem, so maybe he spent his Seder with his sister and his family there, but I like to imagine that Paul, Barnabas, Titus, reclining at the Seder with Simon Peter, probably in the house of Miriam, the mother of John Mark, I think. And that's where they would be staying. It was a big house. She had a big house. She could fit 100 people. I think it should say in our Mishnah, Shimon, Kepha, Bar Yonah, Andre, his brother, Shaul of Tarsus, and Yosef, Barnaba, and Yochanan, Marcus were reclining at a Seder in Yerushalayim, talking about the departure from Egypt all night, until the disciples came and said, "Our masters, it's time for the morning Shema." The sorrow that they felt regarding the death of James had to be postponed. They couldn't sit Shiva for James during the festival. They had to postpone it because it's supposed to be, it's a mitzvah to rejoice. I can almost hear Peter at that table. Remember the words that he spoke? No servant's greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll also persecute you. If they obeyed my teaching, they'll obey you. They'll treat you this way because of my name. Because they don't know the one who sent me. It would be something to be there that night. Anyway, we don't have time to follow the story. You know what happens? Peter ends up being arrested himself during the middle of the feast. He's put in jail. There was no miraculous escape for James, so we don't anticipate any miraculous escape for Peter. But an angel comes to him in the middle of the night. His chains fall from his wrists. The doors open. Peter thinks he's having a vision. He thinks the whole thing is a dream. But the angel says, "Follow me." He follows him out the doors. The guards are still sleeping there that were chained to him. If he follows him out the door, he ends up at the house of Miriam, the mother of Yochanan Marcus, knocking on the door. A girl named Rhoda comes to the door. She sees it as Peter, which is weird for her because they were just inside at that time praying for Peter. And so she closes the door and goes back and tells them, "It's Peter's ghost. He's dead. His spirit, his angel, his spirit is standing at the door." They send her back. He's still there. They let him in. So you know the story. I mean, this is a famous story. A story of Peter in chains. Peter's release. Peter's remarkable release. But what's cool is that Paul and Barnabas were there in Jerusalem at that time. According to the narrative flow of Acts, it's the right time. It's the famine era. It's during the days of scarcity. And it's that's how it's laid out in Acts. So in any case, we have to learn why is he even telling us about this? We'll get to that. Not today. Why is he telling us this story? We'll figure that out next week. In any case, Paul's second trip to Jerusalem after becoming a believer. Here's what he says. He says, "After 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up because of a revelation." Galatians will return to you. Shabbat shalom.